Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Hour of the Time, and I'm Michelle. I will be your host for this program and for as many subsequent programs as it takes to complete the coverage of the material I'm going to begin with you tonight. Over the past few years, I've had the great opportunity to meet many of you on the field, to talk to you on the phone, to get to know you a little better, and without question, the most often requested information that has been presented to me is the request for training about the underground resistance movement and what we on the field can do and should be thinking about with regard to preserving our family life, protecting our liberties. And so we're going to be looking tonight at the basic training handbook of the American Underground. You will probably want to have pencil and paper handy, or if possible, roll audio cassette tape on these programs, because the information will be very valuable to you. I would preface this presentation with the remarks that you do not approach material like this from the perspective of looking for specific strategies or tactics. Rather, you look for broad principles that can be applied or modified to fit a variety of circumstances and conditions. There's no way that you can predict accurately ever exactly what your condition or circumstance may be, and this is the benefit that we have from studying history or studying strategy or studying tactics, is to find the broad applicable principles. The material I will be reviewing with you this evening is somewhat dated. And, of course, we approach material like this with the understanding that we are not anti-government. Our government is the Constitution for the United States of America. And this we support to our last breath. How that government is being manipulated or distorted or twisted or destroyed is another story entirely. But we are not anti-government. You may find some of the language in this handbook that we will be reviewing perhaps a little inflammatory. But again, I request that you look at this from the perspective of principle, realize the material is somewhat dated, and look for what you can use and apply. So we'll take a little break here, and then we'll jump into the material and be ready with pencil and paper.
Lord, where is our freedom? When will our hope begin? Lord, what of the promise you made? When will it come? We have waited for the time, for the truth to live, when justice will shine. To all those
The Basic Training Handbook of the American Underground. American Underground. Is this the name of a new organization? Is it politically to the right or left? How can the term be applied to any activities presently within the United States? Underground is generally defined by most dictionaries as a secret organization fighting established government or occupation forces. 200 years ago, many underground groups were in existence to fight for the cause of freedom. Members of one well-known fraternal organization met, conspired, and perpetrated the act of dumping tea into the Boston Harbor. This is but one example of many underground activities of that time in history. Since that time, and particularly within the last few decades, various groups and organizations have come and gone. Usually served by a biased news media, these groups came into existence as a vehicle to fight what their leaders and membership considered to be paramount of the social ills at hand. Although having their own identities as to enemies to fight, they usually centered around governmental activities that have resulted in unbelievable taxations and encroachment of personal liberty. These underground groups have existed largely as small, autonomous organizations, with their leadership confined to their local area. Tries at national leadership have been made, with varying degrees of success. No one leader has yet reached the level of omnipotence. Perhaps this is largely due to the quality of the general membership. Proponents of individual freedom seem to be the last to be motivated by herd instincts. The more professional underground groups have had membership training programs of varying degrees. The training lessons reproduced in this manual have been in existence for many years and have been modified and used by several groups. The original authorship remains unknown. Capabilities of underground warfare. The capabilities of underground warfare depend on many different factors, such as the size of the area involved, type of terrain, density of population, anti-guerrilla activities, and many other factors. Most important of all is the degree of freedom afforded the civilian population. Cuba served as an example. When Castro was in the mountains fighting Batista, his band was in constant contact with the civilian population. From them, he received information, warning of approaching troops, food, and supplies. The fact that civilians were allowed to travel at will in the foothills made it possible for Castro agents and new recruits to move in disguise to and from his mountain retreat. After Castro came to power and anti-Castro guerrillas were in the mountains, the situation was much different. Castro cleared the no man's land. Thus isolated, the anti-Castro forces could not smuggle in supplies or new recruits. They were deprived of the guerrillas' best means of obtaining information and advance warning of enemy attacks. Another comparison can be made between the Nazi conquest of France and the Chinese communists in Tibet. Although the Germans were often brutal, they did at times display an unexpected degree of chivalry and a sense of fair play. One of the three principal leaders of the French underground was arrested, but he was not executed. Later, he escaped and made his way to England. After being re-equipped, he parachuted back into France and directed guerrilla forces for 2 more years, which resulted in widespread sabotage and untold damage to the German war effort. During all of this time, the guerrilla leader's family lived in France in comparative comfort and safety. The Germans knew who this man was. They knew where his wife and 7 children lived. They could have had his family as hostages and threatened to torture them unless he surrendered, but they did not. Compare this with the communist treatment of civilians in Tibet, Africa, and Southeast Asia. After the communist conquest of Tibet, families were systematically broken up and separated. Adults over 50 were killed or turned out to starve. Children under 15 were shipped to China for communist indoctrination. Married couples were separated. Most men were castrated to make them docile and then sent to slave labor camps. Women were systematically impregnated to start raising a new generation of half-Chinese, half-Tibetan communists. Under conditions such as we have described in France, underground warfare is not only possible, but almost certain. Under conditions as they now exist in Tibet, guerrilla warfare is almost impossible. If the United States ever falls victim to communism, either from within or from without, we must expect treatment as befits our role as the major deterrent to the communist goal of world conquest. Whether such conditions are imposed on our people quickly or slowly probably depends on whether we fight it out or surrender meekly. Sooner or later, the results will be the same. This does not mean that guerrilla warfare against the communist regime in the United States is impossible. It simply means that we must start making our plans and preparations without delay. It means also that we must fight to the death, if necessary, to prevent communist conquest. We must not wait until all hope of victory is gone before we start to fight back. We are facing a determined and crafty enemy. He has thrown away the rules of decency and fair play. He has written an entirely new book of rules. He has written into it every dirty trick and below-the-belt blow that he can think of. If we fail to adopt his set of rules, then we are beaten before we start. In our present situation, we have no other choice but to use every one of the enemy's tricks with a few new ones of our own. Given reasonable conditions of environment and sufficient advance preparation, guerrillas can inflict extreme damage on an enemy and can ultimately lead to the defeat of forces far more numerous and better equipped than themselves. The examples are numerous. Lawrence of Arabia brought about the eventual defeat of Turkey with bands that never totaled over 1,000. For 2 years during the Boer War, a small band of Boer guerrillas held down 250,000 British troops. In Palestine, a handful of fanatics were able to dissipate the strength of an army corps. During World War II, Germany lost as much or more material to guerrilla and underground forces as it did to conventional armies. In one period of just 7 hours, the Russian guerrillas made over 1,000 separate raids against German forces and installations. Just imagine the number of troops that would be required to guard against such widespread guerrilla warfare. The French armies in Vietnam were more numerous, better equipped, and more skillful at conventional warfare. Yet they were ultimately defeated by ragged and illiterate natives that drifted around their outposts and between their lines like smoke through screen wire. The total cost of equipment and supplies by enemy forces in Laos would probably not exceed $500,000. The U.S. has spent over 1,000 times that amount on economic and military assistance and is still losing that country to communism. Castro guerrillas were still outnumbered 1,000 to 1 by the regular army on the day that Batista fled Cuba. The communists think they have a monopoly on guerrilla warfare. We can show them differently. Ever hear of the great American sense of humor? In no other country is the practical joke so widely appreciated or so ingeniously applied as it is in the United States. Sabotage is nothing more than the practical joke carried to its ultimate extreme. We doubt that the communists can even imagine what they would be up against if they tried to put an occupation army in North America. During World War II, the German occupation army in Norway numbered one German for every 18 Norwegians, yet the German troops hardly dared walk the streets at night. German forces occupied Denmark with an average of 6 Germans per square mile, and even though the civilians of that country had few arms of their own, the Germans never completely stamped out the underground activity. Together with our Canadian allies, we number over 300 million and occupy a land mass of over 8 million square miles. It is estimated that the civilian population of the United States alone has in its possession over 60 million rifles, shotguns, and pistols. If this figure sounds like an exaggeration, just consider the fact that Winchester Arms Company has manufactured 3.5 million rifles of one single model. At the present time, it is estimated that the hardware, sporting goods stores, and the people themselves have on hand over 4 billion rounds of ammunition. No wonder the communist sympathizers in this country want us Americans to disarm ourselves through restrictive anti-gun laws. Under the present circumstances, the occupation of North America alone would require an armed force 10 times greater than the total standing armies of Russia and China combined. Of course, they might raise an army sufficiently large, but if they sent their armies over here, who would keep control over their own peoples at home? We're sure the communists are well aware of these facts. It is the American people who fail to realize their own strength. The time may come when communist infiltrators within our government succeed in getting a law passed which would require civilians to register or turn in their firearms. If such a time comes, it is the duty of every patriotic American to do just the opposite. Hide your weapons away. To surrender your arms is to surrender your liberty, and most probably your lives as well. Even after a possible atomic holocaust, there will still be enough of us left to protect our constitutional republic and pass the precious gift of freedom on to future generations, if we are prepared. Perhaps the greatest guerrilla fighters of all time were the American Indians. They lost their battle against the white men not because of poorer weapons or lesser numbers, but rather because they did not realize their danger soon enough and take action while victory was still possible. They also spent considerable time fighting among themselves. If we lose our battle against communism, it will likely be for the same reason. Strategy of guerrilla warfare. In its strategy, technique, and operation, guerrilla warfare is almost the exact opposite of conventional warfare. Conventional warfare is designed to bring the greatest possible concentrations of power to focus at the proper time and place by which the enemy forces can be overwhelmed, defeated, and captured. Guerrilla warfare must be conducted as to cause the greatest possible dispersion of guerrilla forces. F. O. Mich, Chief of Secret Service for General de Gaulle's Free French Forces, has written as follows. In normal war, the objective is perfectly clear, the destruction of the enemy in battle. The battles of underground warfare, if they can be so called, have a totally different character. There is no battlefield in the proper sense of the word, and not one large blow, but a number of small ones are struck ceaselessly in all directions and at all times. One might expect that guerrilla warfare would become less effective as the scientific and technical weapons of war become increasingly more powerful and more complicated. Exactly the opposite is true. Modern armies, like modern governments, have become so bureaucratic that their general commands are usually unable to make or change plans quickly and decisively. Straitjacketed as they are by rigid discipline, junior officers, smaller units, and even the individual soldiers are almost incapable of effective independent action. The guerrilla band, moving faster than the reaction time of conventional forces, may be compared to the small but agile matador that toys with an enraged bull. With every rush, the bull receives another painful jab. Charging wildly here and there, the bull soon dissipates its strength and is at last exhausted and beaten, just waiting for the coup de grace. Mich continues, without underestimating in any way the importance of large-scale employment of modern weapons, man remains the being whose soul brings life to the machine. Thus, the individual combatant, completely disregarding all instinct of self-preservation, can easily succeed in destroying the most deadly and complicated engines of war. The history of the last conflict proves this clearly. Not only has guerrilla warfare survived into the era of airplanes, tanks, and massed armies, but in that era it has reached its highest development. Guerrilla strategy strives to overcome material superiority, not by the employment of more perfect material or by greater numbers, but rather by the use of superior intelligence, greater mobility, and the ultimate degree of courage. Whereas conventional forces try to maintain contact with the enemy, guerrilla forces strive to avoid contact. The essential strategy of guerrilla warfare is said to be the art of constantly escaping from the enemy. Guerrilla bands never seek to hold or occupy territory, not even their own hideout if it should be discovered. Their very existence, even without contact, causes the enemy to expend his energies to guard against them and thus constantly drains the enemy forces of their strength. Instead of driving enemy columns away, the guerrillas strive to constantly lure them farther and farther from their source of supply. Instead of cutting off the enemy outpost's supplies entirely, thus forcing them to retreat, the guerrillas allow short rations to reach such outposts so as to keep them there. The longer they stay, the weaker and more depressed they become. A regular soldier can occupy only the territory within range of his gun. Without a definite target, he is helpless. Thus, a cardinal part of guerrilla strategy is to deny the enemy definite targets. This is not to imply that guerrilla warfare is easy. Just the contrary, it requires an ultimate in skill, cunning, and physical endurance. The matador need make only one mistake, and he ends up on the bull's horns. There are five conditions essential to successful guerrilla warfare. 1. The guerrillas must be intimately acquainted with the area in which they are fighting. 2. They must have plenty of space in which to maneuver. 3. The tenacity, patriotism, and courage of the people must be such as to enable them to fight this type of war. 4. The war must last long enough to allow the underground movement to develop. And 5. The guerrilla forces must receive support from their regular army, from a foreign power, or from a wide cross-section of the general population.
Thank you.
played that lovely song from Riverdance specifically for you because I want you to take a moment and think about the men in your life, whether they're your husbands, your fathers, your sons, the men in your life with whom you've made an emotional investment. Consider for a moment the very real possibility that at some time in the future, we may be separated from these wonderful men. They may be called out onto the field to do a job to fight for our liberty. Some of them may not ever come back. We must also consider the possibility that at some point in the future, we might need to buy back their life or to buy the information of their whereabouts. When you're living in a country that is occupied by the enemy or in a cashless society, you will be reduced to trading on the black market, dealing with the enemy, or working strictly with the underground, and you must have precious metals to do this. There are very few marketable skills or service skills that we women have that are tradable in value to the equivalent of a human life. So think about the necessity of having precious metals on hand as a life preserver. The acquisition of precious metals in a household is not solely the purview of the male head of the house. All family members should take an active interest in acquiring precious metals against the advent of the cashless society, of the economic collapse, of the occupation of the country by enemy force. So without being fearful about this, just use a little common sense. If it's a possibility that you might need it, make that preparation now. We women are very good at preparing in advance. We just need to set our minds to it and take care of it.
Not the dream.
the difference between the mercenary, foreign, invading soldier and the operatives of the underground is the courage of conviction and the moral high ground. These two factors are far greater motivators and will result in victory. Underground movements engage in five separate but overlapping activities. 1. Intelligence, which involves gathering information about the enemy, passing such information on to friendly military forces, use of such information in planning the most effective means of sabotage and guerrilla activities, and misdirecting and confusing enemy forces by planting false or misleading information. 2. Security. This involves protecting the identity of underground personnel and their families, keeping secret the location, movements, and plans of guerrilla bands, keeping secret the location of guerrilla headquarters, alternate hideouts, and supply depots, protecting the identity of civilians or individual members of the enemy population that are friendly to underground forces, protecting the location of friendly military forces that the underground members may have knowledge of, and maintaining secrecy of communications. 3. Propaganda. This is used to convince underground forces themselves of the value of their efforts, the rightness of their cause, and the certainty of ultimate victory. To convince the civilian population that the underground members are true patriots, not bandits, as the enemy will claim, and that it is the duty of the civilian population to render the guerrilla bands every possible assistance, even at certain risk to themselves. To convince enemy forces that they cannot win, to make them doubt the rightness of their own cause, to lower their morale, to confuse their thinking and misdirect their efforts. Propaganda is designed especially to counteract the enemy propaganda. And propaganda, directed to neutral forces and foreign civilians, urges them to join the fight in support of guerrilla forces. 4. Sabotage. This involves active sabotage, designed to destroy enemy resources, supplies, communications, and personnel, or passive sabotage, designed to slow production, misdirect shipments, lose critical machine parts, allow perishable merchandise to spoil, and so forth. 5. Guerrilla warfare. This involves delay enemy troop movements, scout his forces for information, destroy enemy scouts and patrols, ambush enemy columns, mine roads or buildings apt to be used by the enemy, trap or misdirect armored spearheads, raid enemy troops or installations, harass enemy flanks and support forces, cut supply lines, systematically snipe at the enemy officers and troops, deny the enemy use of certain roads, thus concentrating his forces for attack by friendly aircraft, ambush paratroop or amphibious landings of small parties, make the enemy chase you, thereby wearing his troops out and spreading them thin, give the enemy no peace, day or night, good weather or bad, kidnap high-ranking officers and hold them as protection against reprisals on friendly civilians, poison enemy water and food supplies, remove or destroy valuable equipment before it falls into enemy hands, dominate the open country and keep the enemy confined to his own well-guarded barracks, maintain continuous psychological pressure on enemy troops, keep them afraid, lonely, and uncertain, kill the enemy in every possible way, at every possible opportunity, recruit new band members and transport them to the band, maintain systems of supply and distribution, primarily by thefts from the enemy or raids upon his supply depot, secondarily from friendly armed forces or by a fair and equitable tax on the civilian population. Supply individual members with forged identity cards, travel permits, etc. At times, skilled guerrilla forces may even counterfeit money or manufacture their own weapons and explosives. Assist in the escape of friendly prisoners held by the enemy. And cooperate to the fullest extent with any friendly military forces. Guerrilla warfare in North America. Should guerrilla warfare occur on this continent, we would certainly expect it to assume a different character than the guerrilla fighting of Vietnam or even the underground warfare of Europe. The character of the American people is such as to make widespread rebellion almost certain under any form of tyranny. Even among many free nations of Europe, the carrying of identity papers has long been accepted as an unavoidable nuisance. There are very few places in the world outside of the United States in which a person can travel for thousands of miles without first obtaining a passport or visa. Such things as travel permits and identity cards would be the very minimum action that a totalitarian government would insist on to help them control the population. Yet even this would be dramatic proof to the American people that they were no longer free. In other parts of the world, it has generally been found that 90% of the population will submit to occupation by enemy troops without fighting back until their own homes and families are actually attacked. There is every reason to believe that a much greater percentage of the American population would be ready to take up arms against a foreign invader or a communist-imposed government. We have already mentioned the large population and immense land mass that would be involved. Room to maneuver, as we have seen, is one of the necessities of successful guerrilla warfare. Throughout the United States, Canada, and Mexico, the wide variety of terrain and population density would lend itself naturally to unrelenting sabotage and guerrilla activity. We have also mentioned the role of surplus food and supplies in the support of underground warfare. Even after an atomic holocaust, it is hard to imagine a complete absence of surplus food, including both domestic and wild-growing plants, which the guerrilla band could draw on for sustenance. In the United States proper, the transportation, highway, and road systems are in a completely different class from other areas which have experienced guerrilla warfare. Even in that part of Russia which was occupied by the Germans, the road system was comparatively primitive. Horse-drawn vehicles were common, and the large bulk of the people moved on foot. Guerrilla bands in other parts of the world have successfully moved themselves and materials by foot over jungle trails and through mountainous ravines. The distances involved, however, were comparatively small. Through the United States alone, there are literally millions of miles of roads, paved highways, blacktops, gravel roads, and dirt. How is an enemy to keep watch on all of this seemingly endless labyrinth of roads? To the average communist soldier, they would be as confusing as wilderness trails. In view of these differences, it may well be that guerrilla bands operating in the United States could use motor transportation and mechanized weapons to an extent which has not previously been possible in guerrilla warfare. Naturally, we cannot really know whether such fighting will ever be required of us. Neither can we know what kind of enemy we may have to fight or under what conditions. It may be that the guerrilla fighter of the North American continent will be best equipped with a camouflage suit, pack of survival rations, and an automatic rifle. On the other hand, it might well occur that the North American guerrilla will be best camouflaged while wearing a business suit and carrying a briefcase with a silencer-equipped pistol. These are things to consider. Think over now and prepare for the future. Underground training program. It would be a mistake to think that our enemies have one set plan for world conquest. They are maintaining many continuous attacks on many fronts at the same time, military, political, and psychological, both internal and external. They are continuously probing for weak spots in the defenses of the free world. During the past 30 years, so many openings have been left to them by the stupidity and collusion of Western leaders that they have been able to advance almost at will. There is little we can do to change this situation at this time. Rather than deplete our limited resources on futile attempts to do so, we must concentrate on building a workable anti-communist underground army based on realities rather than wishful thinking and organized on the tried and proven principles of underground warfare. The communists have many, many years of experience in suppressing anti-communist guerrilla activity. If we are to fight them successfully, if we are to hold out until the final victory of freedom over tyranny, then our underground army is going to have to be the most skillful and the most dedicated that the world has ever known. There is only one kind of member that can qualify for such an army, the very best. This will require intensive training and practice. There is no shortcut to perfection. By drawing on the talents of several of our more experienced members, we think we now have a training program that can develop that kind of an underground army. In this program, four different types of training will be involved: printed material, tape recordings, pictures, slides, charts, and so forth, sold or loaned to bands or individuals, actual experience, on-the-job training by doing assignments, and training maneuvers. Due to the difficulty of keeping large training meetings secret, such sessions should be held only for small, select groups that have already completed sufficient preliminary training by other means. Phase 1. Intelligence, Security, and Propaganda. Phase 1 of this training program is designed to give our members basic knowledge and practice in intelligence, security, and propaganda. This first phase is basic preparation for advanced training in these three important activities, which will be dealt with in greater detail further on in the training program. Intelligence. Guerrilla warfare, as we customarily think of it, cannot succeed unless it is supported by a well-developed underground, comprising all the essential functions of intelligence, security, propaganda, communication, supply, medical services, and so forth. Of all of these, intelligence is the most important. Let's consider one example. Suppose you picked up a telephone book, opened it up to any page at random, closed your eyes, and put your finger to one name. Now suppose you read that name for the first time and said to yourself, "Sometime in the next 30 days, I'm going to kill this man." Consider the situation. One man, picked at random, is marked for death. He might be the most powerful, the wealthiest, the most influential man in the city, but none of these things would help him in the least. He would be defenseless. Why? Because you would have one thing that he did not have: intelligence. You would know his identity and he would not know yours. So long as that condition continued, there would be no possible way in which he could arrange an adequate defense against you. Exactly the same situation exists between ourselves and our communist socialist enemies. Our success will be directly proportional to our knowledge of them and inversely proportional to their knowledge of us. Whatever a member's principal job may be in the underground army, he must have a basic knowledge of intelligence techniques. This subject is therefore the first to be considered in our training program. And we will continue this in another episode of the Hour of the Time. I thank you for your attention and ask that you weigh these matters very carefully and think about them prayerfully. And until we meet again, may God bless you and God save the Republic.